Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Konser. And today we're talking about Pacific Northwest history and art. We have a couple of guests with us. Our good friend Greg Hamilton will join us later in the show. But first, let's welcome an acclaimed author and art curator who will be telling us all about the experimental filmmaker Harry Smith. Ronnie Singh, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
Well, Ronnie, I said that Harry Smith was an experimental filmmaker, but he was so much more. He was a painter and collage artist, a mystic, a student of anthropology, a collector of folk music and indigenous art, and an important, though unsung, figure in the Beat Generation.
That's correct. It's really hard to sum up all his accomplishments and all the various areas that he worked in.
Well, let's talk about this film that you're bringing to Portland, the city, by the way, of Harry Smith's birth. It's called film number 18, Mahagoni. And this score is based on the Kurt Weill, Bertolt Brecht opera, The Rise and Fall of the City of Mahagoni.
Exactly. I mean, this film has such a long and storied, complicated history, and it's really fascinating that your radio program deals with the idea of narrative arts. The film is 2.5-hour four-screen film that Harry Smith spent about 10 years working on. And the film's soundtrack, it's synchronized exactly to the Kurt Weill Bertolt Brecht opera, Mahagoni. And it was the 1956 version starring Lottie Lenya.
She might be best known to many of our listeners as the villain in the second James Bond film, From Russia with Love.
Exactly, exactly. And The Doors, you know, show me the way to the next whiskey bar. That's often how people are familiar with some of the songs from the Mahagoni Songspiel. But just briefly, the film is synchronized to the opera, and it's worthwhile to learn a little bit and understand about the synopsis for the opera. And before the screening, we actually have program notes, which delineate what the story is, because in a very loose and interpretive and creative way, the film kind of tracks the story of the opera. And the story is quite interesting in the sense that it was set in a mythological American city in Pensacola, Florida, and a handful of other cities. And it's really the story of like the rise and fall of man. And really the rise is due to basically the seven deadly sins of greed and sloth. And that's also the downfall of man. And in a very interesting way, Harry Smith's Mahagoni tracks that in his life and in his surroundings, and it's captured on film. Much of the film is centered around his friends and cohorts at the Chelsea Hotel in New York City. And as you probably know, the Chelsea Hotel has its own storied history, but there was a lot of really colorful characters that were living there, very important authors and historians and musicians and writers and, you know, from everywhere, one from Dylan Thomas to Bob Dylan to, surprisingly, while Harry Smith was working on his film, Stefan Brecht and Lottie Lenya were working on a off-Broadway rendition of Mahagoni. And Arnold Weinstein, who makes a brief appearance in the film, was doing the first English translation of the opera. And him and Harry Smith got to be, you know, good friends and often discussed the opera. But Harry Smith never let on to Arnold Weinstein that he was actually working on his own version of Mahagoni. But I digress a little bit. You know, the film is Harry Smith calls it a structural analysis of Marcel Duchamp's The Bride Stripped Bare of her bachelor's, even. And it's hard to kind of track what he was actually referring to, but the film does have a very specific structure to it. It is structured around a palindrome, and it is comprised of people, animation, nature scenes, and you can see the interplay throughout the film, that occasionally there's a kind of mirroring of the images, and then there's a point, counterpoint. So it's really very layered in terms of how the four screens work with one another. When Harry Smith presented it, it was presented on four 16 millimeter projectors. And that is a very complicated presentation mode. As you can imagine, you know, you need four separate projectionists. And when Harry Smith showed it, he was there at every screening. And it only showed for maybe 6-8 times at Anthology Film Archives in 1980, while Smith was alive. And that was it. And then in 2000, 2001, the Harry Smith Archives and myself, we were working with the Getty Research Institute to present the film again. And we made the decision to transfer it to a 35 millimeter film. And that was really for ease of presentation. And at that point, it had to be, you know, kind of locked into place. So it became, you know, somewhat of a different type of performance and presentation. And now how we'll be showing it at the Clinton Street Theater is in a new 4K transfer. So it's, you know, we're now in a new digital technology. And so we have a new way of presenting it in a digital presentation. And this is actually the West Coast premiere of the film. It's only shown a handful of times before in the new digital presentation.
Wow. Well, some people have called Mahogany a mathematical puzzle. Harry was very much into esoteric spirituality and higher math and a melding of cultures. But in some ways, it's also a bit of a historical document because, like you said, Harry was living at the Chelsea Hotel and some of his neighbors there were Patti Smith. She was living with Robert Mapplethorpe. Harry and Patti became close friends. And this was New York at its grittiest. So there's a lot of footage of New York in a time when, well, for one thing, artists who were not making huge salaries could still afford to live in Manhattan, sometimes in huge lofts.
No, exactly, Conch. You know, the film captures New York at this moment. It's really a time capsule. And part of that is what makes it so captivating to see the streets of New York, the Chelsea Hotel, outside the Chelsea Hotel, you know, in 1970, Harry Smith shot the film between 1970 and 1972. And then he edited the film for the next 8 years. But the time period where he was working on the film and shooting all the footage of Central Park and 42nd Street and Times Square, Chelsea Hotel, Staten Island Ferry, New York was really going through a very difficult time. And the city was bankrupt. There was a garbage strike. I mean, it was really a down and out time. And it's captured in the film in this pristine way that's really haunting in a sense. And I think that's what people find so engaging about watching the film, you know, especially now it's New York that is so different than it was back then.
Well, one of the people who appears on screen is the beat poet extraordinaire, Allen Ginsberg, who called Harry unique, devious, saintly. And at one point, when Harry was behind on his rent, Allen Ginsberg invited him to live with him at his place on the Lower East Side. And Harry designed the covers to two of Ginsberg's books of poetry.
You know, watching Mahogany, there's so much to decode and there's so many different people and stories and hints and all this backstory and everything. You know, I've seen the film so many times and it's, it continues to engage me. It's really phenomenal. But you talk about Allen Ginsberg to start. They were dear friends for so many years. But even more importantly, Allen was such a support system for Harry and really enabled him to complete many of his projects. And as you say, he lived with him a few different times when he was really down and out and living in a single room occupancy hotel and on the Bowery. I mean, it was very, very sad. He had really reached rock bottom. But Allen was very supportive, and it was Allen Ginsberg who ended up bringing him to Naropa Institute in Boulder, Colorado, and installing him there as the shaman in residence and a professor, and he taught classes there. And Harry Smith stayed there for 3.5 years before he passed away, and those years were some of his most productive and robust time in his life. I mean, it was really a pleasure to see. And that's when I got to know Harry Smith during that time at Naropa Institute. You also just alluded to, it's worth pointing out some of the other characters that are in the film, Jonas Mekas, who ran Anthology Film Archives. They were so close, and he is also responsible for taking care of Harry Smith's films, supporting Harry, having Harry be like the filmmaker in residence at Anthology, and have Harry being able to store his films and go work at Anthology. And to this day, Anthology Film Archives is responsible for doing really beautiful new restorations of the films that we showed at the recent Whitney Museum exhibition, which will now open at Harvard at the Carpenter Center in July. And also a few other characters, as you mentioned, Patti Smith and Robert Mapplethorpe, both of whom appear in the film. And Robert Mapplethorpe in particular, his studio and these sculptures that he was working on that contained all this jewelry and paraphernalia and material that he was putting together, these like almost totems in a way. And that's just to name a few of the people who appear in the film. You know, they really are kind of a cryptic way of unpacking Harry Smith's life at that time and the various things that he was thinking of, as you mentioned before, these, you know, esoteric systems.
You mentioned the Naropa Institute in Colorado, and this is where you came into the picture. Allen Ginsberg had been sending Harry rent money, but Harry was using it all to buy alcohol. So you were hired as Harry's assistant, and the rest is history.
Well, at that point, Allen brought Harry to Boulder to teach for the summer. And Allen had the plan, I think, all along to, you know, when the summer was finished, to basically leave him there. And Allen would go back to New York, leaving Harry there. And it wasn't such a bad idea, but I don't think he consulted with Harry Smith about it before he did it. But just to clarify, at that juncture, Harry was not drinking anymore at all. And I think that really had a lot to do with his period of productivity and dare I say, healthy lifestyle in Boulder. But yes, he was not drinking at all. But he did, you know, after Allen left him with some money when he left town, he very quickly spent, you know, whatever his month's expenses were at various bookstores in town, in addition to running up, you know, bills that were in the hundreds of dollars. So, you know, at that point, I think Allen realized that Harry needed somebody who was a little bit more controlling of his resources and somebody just to watch out for him and, you know, make sure that he, you know, was able to get groceries and go on bookstore runs and just somebody to help facilitate his lifestyle and his time in Boulder, Colorado.
Well, you've definitely dedicated yourself to furthering Harry Smith's legacy. You mentioned the retrospective at the Whitney Museum of American Art, Fragments of a Faith Forgotten, The Art of Harry Smith. And several years ago, you co-edited a book with Andrew Perchik called Harry Smith, The Avant-Garde in the American Vernacular.
it's been amazing to see the trajectory of Harry Smith's legacy. And especially that was on view this past fall when the Whitney Museum opened up their exhibition. And that exhibition featured, you know, all of Harry Smith's films and his collections, his work with the Native Americans and Indigenous peoples, his anthology of American folk music, and his drawings and string figures and tarot cards and, you know, all the various collections of things that he was interested in. And the exhibition got noted in the New York Times with a huge review and the best of art exhibitions in 2024. So it was great. And we received a lot of critical attention. And then at the same time, there's a new biography out by noted author John Zwed, and it's called Cosmic Scholar. And it's a full scale biography of Harry Smith. And it's an incredible read because he attempted to do the impossible, which is pull together all these various lives and strands of Harry Smith's interests and his history. And so he really has done the impossible. And it's a very entertaining and you know, almost unbelievable read. I recommend it to anybody who wants to know more. But yeah, just to see that trajectory of, you know, how the understanding and awareness of Harry Smith's work over the years has been very rewarding. And as I mentioned, the exhibition will open at the Carpenter Center at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts in July of this year. And then in end of September, they'll be having a whole weekend of public programs and film screenings. And then the exhibition in somewhat different form will also travel to the Bob Dylan Center in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So that's something to watch out for if any of your listeners are traveling to Massachusetts or Oklahoma.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And today we're talking with Ronnie Singh, the director of the Harry Smith Archives. She'll be bringing the Harry Smith film Mahagoni to Portland's Clinton Street Theater next Monday, the 17th of June. You mentioned all of Harry's films and artwork, and I guess we should make that all the surviving films and artwork because, unfortunately, there were times when, you know, Harry might be evicted, put out on the street, or, you know, he might go into a rage or something like that, and some of his work would be lost or destroyed.
You know, it's somewhat disheartening to think about all of the work that had been lost over the years, because whether it was his own destruction or having to move and leave things behind or give it to people or trade or barter, whatever, you know, having to move several times, as you know, packing your things up and bringing them along is not always possible. And there's an apocryphal story of him, you know, leaving for Oklahoma to conduct his recording of the Kiowa Peyote ceremony and not paying the rent on his apartment. And when he came back, everything was gone. And that material supposedly was thrown into the landfill on Staten Island.
Oh,
so,
no.
You know, we're so lucky to have the things that survive. And it was really fascinating at the Whitney exhibition because the way we chose to present some things, we had to use the form and the material in the format that we had available. So for instance, he did these very elaborate jazz paintings, and they were synchronized to Dizzy Gillespie and Thelonious Monk jazz tracks. And they only existed because the filmmaker Jordan Belson had saved these transparencies and negatives of the work. So to this day, the work itself, to our knowledge, doesn't survive, but it does in these beautiful 4x5 transparencies, which were blown up and backlit. And I mean, I've known those images for so long, but to see them blown up and backlit, it was amazing. You could make out every line, every stroke, every color. I mean, it was really phenomenal. So yeah, we are all very appreciative of the work that survives.
Well, you have been in Portland before for one of the screenings of a Harry Smith film. This was the feature film, Heaven and Earth Magic, which screened at Portland's Hollywood Theater back in 2015. The imagery in that film is very dreamlike. The technique is cutout animation, sort of a collage piece in motion. And the screening itself, it involved a couple of different projectors, overlapping images, that sort of thing. Very extravagant animations.
Yeah, you know, we've had a handful of screenings in Portland over the years, and they've all been very well attended. And it's excellent that for this upcoming week, you know, the weekend of June 15th to the 17th, that there'll be three distinct programs. So on June 15th at the Hollywood Theater, Eric Isaacson from Mississippi Records is organizing a program, and it will be with a handful of different live musical accompaniment. And then Sunday at Turn, 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 there'll be a program about Harry Smith and the Pacific Northwest, and that will include Brett Lunsford, who did a book recently called Sounding for Harry Smith. And Brett is located in Anacortes, Washington, and he wrote and published an incredible book that talks about Anacortes and Bellingham around the time of Harry Smith's childhood. And he weaves in the history of the region along with the salmon canning industry and the indigenous people, the Lummi and the Swinomish and the Samish peoples, and Harry Smith's work with them and his engagement with the area. And it's a phenomenal book. And he'll be in conversation with Darren Daniel, who also published the selected interview book of Harry Smith. And I also, I believe Chuck Pirtle, who was a friend of Harry Smith's, who knew him, they'll be in conversation. And then, yeah, 2 days later, Monday, June 17th at the Clinton Street Theater, we'll be showing Mahogany, you know, the premiere of the 4K restoration, the Portland premiere of the restoration. So it's a whole weekend of Harry Smith events.
So Harry's early life was spent in Northwest Washington, and his mother taught school on the Lummi Indian Reservation. So that's when Harry became fascinated with indigenous culture. And so as a teenager, he was already an ethnologist. He was participating in Lummi dances and rituals and studying native music and ritual art.
Harry Smith was actually born in Portland, Oregon, and then the family moved to Washington State in the Bellingham and Anacortes area. And his father worked at the Pacific American Fisheries Salmon Canning Company. And it was thought to believe that his mother taught on the Lummi Indian Reservation, but it hasn't been verified. I think we have to confirm that. What's interesting is that both Brett Lunsford and John Zwed, the biographer, have tried to find actual proof of that and have been unable to. But that being said, Harry's time in the Pacific Northwest had a very distinct way of shaping his interests and his outlook for the rest of his life. There's no question about that. It was a very definitive period of time in which he was able to document the indigenous peoples of the Pacific Northwest and work on their language and their rituals and music. And he started collecting his records that would eventually become part of the collection that went onto the Anthology of American Folk Music. So, yes, I mean, I can't overstate enough how the Pacific Northwest shaped his outlook and his lifelong achievements and endeavors.
Well, as you said, Harry was a big collector of folk records from the 1920s and 1930s. These featured a lot of what was called hillbilly and race records at the time. These were 78 RPM records, and he brought his collection to Folkways, hoping to sell them the records. Instead, Folkways convinced him to put together a compilation for them. So that was the 1952 Anthology of American Folk Music. And Harry did all the artwork for the anthology, as well as, you know, editing the music that went into it. And this was a collection that ended up influencing people like Bob Dylan, Philip Glass, and Jerry Garcia.
Exactly. I mean, his record collecting began in the Pacific Northwest in the post-war period. And that was a time when you could get 78 RPM records for next to nothing. People were turning them in. They were being used to melt down. He was able to go to Salvation Army and various record stores and get some of these records for next to nothing. And he ended up amassing hundreds, if not thousands, of these records. And when he moved to New York City, he had them shipped out. When he arrived in New York, he was in need of some financial support. And he was referred to Moses Ash at Folkways Records. So he went to Moses with the intention of selling him records. And in turn, Mo Ash asked Harry to create his own collection of records because he could tell that Harry Smith had a very like erudite knowledge of that material and really was able to collate and put together this collection of records that really had been made for regional audiences in the United States. And so oftentimes records that were made in, you know, North Carolina, people in, you know, Washington, D.C., perhaps really weren't able to hear these records. And so Harry Smith in the anthology put together a tapestry of his vision for America. And author Grail Marcus calls it the old weird America. And he was able to, you know, put this collection of records, it was six LPs, along with a very distinctive booklet, as you mentioned. And the booklet was essentially of an art object, a collage of cutouts from various catalogs and other records. And he put together for each song very pithy descriptions of the narrative of each song and the narrative according to Harry Smith, which is, you know, his own way of thinking about these songs. And he also included bibliography or other versions of the songs. And for people who are interested, I really recommend seeking it out because it's a unique presentation of not only music that was being made in the 20s and 30s, but really a picture of a very layered and complex America at that time.
And the Anthology of American Folk Music earned Harry Smith a special Grammy Award in 1991.
Exactly. He got a Lifetime Achievement Award, and he was given the award at the pre-Grammy ceremony by Bill Ivey. And he went to the podium to accept his award and stated something along the lines of, you know, I live to see my dreams come true. I've seen America change through music.
Wow. Yeah. And I understand he came into New York from Colorado and he got a rented tuxedo and he had five kittens with him.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was his last visit. You know, he left Boulder and came back once, but for just a brief time, but eventually ended up holing up at the Chelsea Hotel again until he passed away there on November 23rd in 1991.
And it must have been quite the task to move all of his things out after he died. I mean, in addition to his collection of folk records, his own artwork, his films, you'd also collect everything from Seminole patchwork quilts to Ukrainian decorative eggs.
Well, I think excavation and an archaeological dig is more appropriate because essentially the materials that Harry Smith had when he passed away were only a very, very small portion of what exists today. That material that was at the Chelsea Hotel and the his apartment in Boulder, Colorado, was just the material that he had at that moment. And so essentially the work of the Harry Smith Archives, you know, for the next 10, 15, 20 years was to research, locate, find the work, and to conserve it, to preserve it, and to present it. And so it was really an act of speaking to, connecting to many friends and colleagues. Over the years, he left a lot of material at Allen Ginsberg's apartment, and friends like Patrick Hulsey and M. Henry Jones and Anthology Film Archives. And so one person would lead you to the next person, which would say, oh, well, you have to go talk to that person. So what started out as, you know, a handful of boxes really ended up being a large collection of materials. The Harry Smith papers are housed at the Getty Research Institute in Los Angeles in special collections. And Harry Smith's books and records are at the Bob Dylan Center in Tulsa, Oklahoma, in the archive there. So for people who are interested in doing research, those two libraries are the places to go.
Well, the one thing that people always say about Harry is that he was a true polymath. He appreciated all the cultures, all the art, all of the spirituality that he came across. And Harry would often greet people by saying, "Have you been creative today?"
Well, that's a wonderful, apt way of describing him, that he was a polymath and interested in so many different types of media and religions and cross-cultural connections. And that's so much of what is at the core and the essence of his work. And yes, you're right, that he would greet people asking them, "Have you been creative today?" So, and that's something that stays with me. You know, oftentimes, you know, I find myself asking myself that.
Well, you're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Konser. And we've been talking today with Ronnie Singh, the director of the Harry Smith Archives. She'll be bringing the Harry Smith film Mahagoni to Portland's Clinton Street Theater next Monday, the 17th of June. Ronnie, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure. I look forward to seeing everybody there on Monday, June 17th at the Clinton Street Theater for the premiere of Harry Smith's magnum opus, Mahagoni.
In 4K. And tell us a little bit about the other events that'll be happening and how people can find out more about Harry Smith.
Well, on Saturday, June 15th, Mississippi Records is hosting a Harry Smith 100th birthday celebration, and that's at 7:30 p.m. And that will feature the Portland Sacred Harp Singers, a Roman Norfleet, and Be Present Art Group, Coalate and Jay Ringer. And they'll be showing some of Harry Smith's best known films, accompanied by live musicians performing a lot of the songs that Harry himself would play when he was screening the films. So we'll be showing mirror animations and a seminal patchwork film accompanied by the Portland Sacred Harp Singers. And then we'll be also screening Early Abstractions, a series of hand-painted films accompanied by Collate. They dub themselves a high-caliber angular rock band, so I don't know what to expect. And then finally, they'll be screening film number 14, Late Superimpositions, accompanied by Roman Norfleet and the Be Present Art Group. And then Sunday afternoon at 4 p.m., Turn, there'll be a program I mentioned before, Harry Smith and the Pacific Northwest, that will feature a conversation with Brett Lunsford, author of Sounding for Harry Smith, with Darren Daniel, who edited the selected interview book, and Chuck Pirtle, who was a friend of Harry Smith. And there will also be Catherine Factor is organizing this event, and she's done an incredible job of bringing together a handful of poets and various people who will be reading poems and presenting string figures. Jazz musician and scholar Tim DeRoche and Andrew Oliver will be there. And then in addition to Catherine Factor, the poet, Lawrence Lilvick and Christopher Luna will be reading some poems. So they're going to be talking, really trying to focus on Harry's connection to the Pacific Northwest and, you know, bringing his diverse interest in string figures, Native Americans, record collecting, and esoterica, bringing that all together.
Wow. Is there one place where people can read up all about these events?
Yeah, on the Harry Smith Archives website, there's a listing program, and on Instagram and Facebook, there'll be also constantly updated information.
Well, Ronnie, thanks again, and we'll look forward to seeing you here in Portland.
Great. Thanks. Pleasure. I'll see you all soon.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Counser. And we've been talking today with Ronnie Singh, the director of the Harry Smith Archives. She'll be bringing the Harry Smith film Mahagoni to Portland's Clinton Street Theater next Monday, the 17th of June. We'll be right back with Greg Hamilton. And now we're joined by documentarian and film archivist Greg Hamilton. He's here to tell us about a movie that he'll be showing at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. And it's being screened as a tribute of sorts to a local sports legend and cultural figure. Greg, always a pleasure to have you here.
It's great to be back, Conch. Thanks for having me on.
So tell us about Fast Break.
Well, Fast Break has been around for quite a while. And for those that are fans of the Portland Trailblazers here in town, it is the only documentary that was made about the team when they won the world championship in 1977. And that was the year that that Bill Walton was a part of that team. And I have brought the film back for a special screening over at the Hollywood Theater on Wednesday, June 19th at 7:30. And it's going to be kind of a tribute to Bill, who passed away recently of cancer. And we're hoping to get fans together, people that that knew Bill, just to watch the movie, commiserate, talk about him afterwards. We're going to have some special guests. It's going to be great. But the film itself is really kind of an unusual thing of its time. Produced, like I said, in 1978, the year after they won. And it has access to players that you would never, ever get these days. And specifically with Bill, it gives you an insight into like what kind of person he was, not only as a player, but also as a human being.
Now, the film takes place during the 76 to 77 season. Give us a sense of Portland in 1977 when this documentary was filmed. The Trailblazers team had only been around for a few years. Nobody expected them to go all the way to the finals, let alone win.
Well, you know, I mean, Bill Walton had actually been with the team for a couple of years, and he had been experiencing some injuries that derailed him a little bit. But that year when they went for it all, and they weren't expected to, they kind of came out of nowhere in some ways. But that year, they found the magic sauce, I guess. And, you know, combined that with, you know, with the community that really was behind them, they managed to put it all together. And the film itself was actually kind of started like when they were early in the playoffs during that time. And so they filmed them during that period, all through the playoffs and through the finals. And then afterwards, after that, after they had won it all, then the filmmakers went back and interviewed the individual players and kind of got to know them a little better. But yeah, it's really a unique film. And like I said, a portrait of another time, quite honestly.
Well, let's play a clip from the documentary Fast Break.
Basketball is part of living, you know, and almost everything that works in basketball, you know, has its same, counterparts in your regular life away from basketball. You know, the same tricks work, and when you mess up, they call a foul on you.
Richie Powers hands the ball into Cheney. Here we go. The inbound to Tatum. Back to Cheney to Jabbar. You know it. Don't foul. They surround Jabbar. There's the jumper. It's not going to go. Rebound batted back by the Lakers, and it rolls down the floor, and it's going to be Portland. So the horn is sounded. The game is over. Ramsey and Walton hug one another. It was defense, defense, defense. Jabbar took the shot high in the air. He missed it. The game is over. The Blazers win it. Two in a row here in Los Angeles. My, oh my. Rip City.
That was a clip from the documentary Fast Break. We heard legendary Trailblazers center Bill Walton, followed by commentator Bill Shonley, who we also lost not so long ago.
Yeah, we played it when Bill passed as well, and we celebrate the players and everybody that's involved in the organization that was a part of that film. So it's become kind of a little bit of a memory piece for the city and just for fans of the team.
Well, Greg, let's say that some of our listeners are big fans of documentary film and Pacific Northwest culture, but not so much professional sports fans. Why should they come out and see this film?
Well, it is a very, very non-traditional sports film documentary, if there ever was one. For people who that have lived here in Portland or lived in Oregon, for example, it really is like it's a slice of time. And it tackles the sport, but it really focuses on the people. And you get these individual portraits, not only of the players, but the coaches. It's a very personal film in some ways, but it's also got its own vibe. It's very 70s. It's kind of got this verite feeling. There was a moniker that was attached to it. They called it Stoner Verite because there's music that's in there that kind of pushes it in that direction. But it's fun to see Portland back in the 70s, to see the enthusiasm, to see just the time and place. And so for folks that live here that have not seen it, that may not be sports fans, I would encourage you to come out to check it out, if only just to get a little slice of that history here in Portland that that they may not know.
Well, like you said, there are so many informal moments in this film, and this is among these professional athletes in the 1970s. You couldn't imagine those moments being captured nowadays, that camaraderie and that informality.
Yeah, no, the one thing that you will notice is the access that the filmmakers had to the players. I mean, specifically Bill Walton. One of the folks that we're going to have for the film is Larry Colton, who was a writer at the time who wrote a book about the Trailblazers when the film was being made. And he was called at the last minute to come and do a bike ride with Bill down the Oregon coast. And there's a whole sequence in the film that's about that. And it's, you know, it has nothing to do with basketball, but it's everything about them just kind of like trolling down the coast and then going at each other because Bill is obviously a much better conditioned athlete. But, you know, the access that they had to the players, you would never, ever see these days. And that's what makes the film special, is that you get inside a little bit of the skin of these individuals and you see them for the people that they are, you know, outside of the court. And that's what makes it special. And that's why it's cool to watch it and think about Bill, because we see so much of him in the film.
Yes, the bicycle adventure on the Oregon coast, that is a highlight. And it really shows off what a colorful character Bill Walton is. He was well-loved later in life for his color commentary, his podcasting. His ideas could veer off in interesting directions.
Oh, that's for sure. You know, it's interesting because earlier in his career, a lot of people, you know, knew that that Bill had an issue with stuttering. And that's evident in the film. You see that come and go, but you can also see him progressing as a public speaker, but also, you know, just in his ability to interact with folks. There's a sequence, in fact, where he's out at the Warm Springs Reservation doing a basketball camp. And that is also one of my favorite sequences in the film, just because, you know, he's out there playing with the kids. And there's a moment there where one of the camp counselor tells Bill, she says, some of the kids can come and get lunch, you know, if they've paid for the camp and whatnot. And the other kids, you know, can't have that. And Bill gets up to do the announcement and say that. And he says to the kids that, you know, may not have paid for this, you know, just come and see me and I'll slip you a little something on the side. And that was just, that's Bill. Straight up. And like I said, just one of many, many moments in that film that is just very personal and enjoyable to watch.
Huh. Okay, well, one more time, tell the folks where they can see the documentary Fast Break on the big screen and with an appreciative crowd.
Yes, please come out to the Hollywood Theater on Wednesday, June 19th at 7:30. Tickets are selling quickly from what I've been told. Lots of people are looking forward to getting together and sharing this experience. So come out to the Hollywood, June 19th, Wednesday, 7:30. I'll be there and hope you will be too.
All right. You've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and we've been talking today with Ronnie Singh and Greg Hamilton. Thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on social media at Words and Picture.